If sports are the great escapism, consider this your ultimate sports asylum. This is Sportsnet Tonight on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Oh, we've got ourselves a series here. World Series knotted up at one game apiece after Tampa's 6-4 win tonight. A sprint edition of Sportsnet tonight. Brent Gunning here, Rob Wong alongside me. That game was a little bit of a slog at times, Rob. Ended up getting interesting towards the end. Definitely didn't have the sprint feel that this show is going to have out of the gate. I'll bring you in right now. Rob, how you doing tonight, and how'd you enjoy tonight's game?
Yeah, definitely not as, I would say, fun or enjoyable as game number one. I thought game number one just had a lot more dramatic moments, but game two still was pretty good. It's always nice when you can get a playoff baseball game done in less than 4 hours, because I know some of these games that we've seen so far in the postseason just have felt like they've taken absolutely forever, and this one was, you know, definitely going through the motions at one point with all the pitching changes on both sides, and the Dodgers using, you talked about, you know, prior to the game, it was essentially going to be a bullpen game, and they end up using seven pitchers out of the pen tonight after Tony Gonsolin was the opener in this one. So the Rays coming out on top, 6-4. Blake Snell, we'll talk about it coming up here shortly, but he was phenomenal tonight, and this one is a series. I didn't think it was going to be a sweep by any means. I thought it was going to be a back-and-forth affair. Both of these pitching staffs are really, really good, and we saw that tonight with Blake Snell and the Rays bullpen able to hold it down.
I won't bury the lead. We will get to Blake Snell. He was tremendous tonight, but I think it's important to remind everyone of what this Rays win means. It means we get at least one more referendum on Clayton Kershaw. I'm pretty sure probably going to see him in game five. So I'm sure we'll both yell and scream about that plenty more times before this series is done. But yeah, let's talk about Blake Snell a little bit. Just flat out dominant early. He's only a third pitcher in World Series history with two strikeouts in four straight innings. Anytime you join a club that is only Sandy Koufax and Bob Gibson, I'd say that's a pretty good day. I'm surprised he was that dominant. You know, not that Snell's not a great pitcher, not that he couldn't do well against this Dodgers lineup, but, you know, this is a guy who I think who likes to work around the edges of the zone, and we've seen how patient this Dodgers team can be at times, but I have to give him credit. He was tremendous tonight, and, you know, he was doing just the right amount, nibbling and mixing in plenty of pitches on the plate as well, so I have to tip my cap to him. Are you at all surprised at how good he was tonight?
No, not really, just because we know how talented of a pitcher he can be. I think he made a great point that he is, you know, more of a guy that expands the zone, you know, early and sort of nibbles on the edges, makes you chase, and then at that point, it's really tough to come back because his pitches are so good that he can make you chase anything with two strikes. I'm a little bit surprised that they did take him out when they did. Kevin Cash made the move in the fifth. I know there was a couple of runners on, and it's 5-2, and he had just given up a home run to Chris Taylor, and a walk to Mookie Betts and a single to Corey Seager, but I thought he was pitching pretty well. And we saw last night, you know, Tyler Glasnow was left in there till, you know, 100-plus pitches. So, you know, considering, you know, Blake Snell is one of the top two pitchers on this staff, I thought maybe Kevin Cash would give him the benefit of the doubt, maybe let him face Justin Turner. But this is all, you know, Tampa Bay Rays-esque, that you need a guy to put out the fire. You're bringing in, you know, Nick Anderson in that spot, a guy that's closed out games for you this year to nip that in the bud right there. And that ended up being a massive, massive moment in the game as he strikes out Justin Turner to keep it a three-run game at the time. But if you're Blake Snell, I think you gain a lot of confidence from this. I'm sure he wished he could have gone a little bit further because he was dealing, and to only make it into the fifth inning and not get out of the fifth inning was pretty disappointing. But I imagine he'll take the win because, as we saw, you know, earlier in the postseason, when you ask players, do you take any positives away from winning games? That's nothing you ever really want to talk about at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's better than asking a guy about his pants after a loss.
That's true.
We will see Mr. Tight Pants himself, Walker Buehler, on the mound in Game 3. But I was kind of flicking back and forth between the two feeds of the game. Of course, we have the wonderful international feed on Sportsnet, which I recommend you watch, and you can also do so via the Sportsnet app there. I think I've covered all my bases. But I also checked out the Fox feed as well, and I thought John Smoltz made a really, really good point on the broadcast that because pitchers are so conditioned, especially Rays pitchers, to getting yanked out of these games early, you know, normally if you think of kind of Smoltz era of pitchers, you would have had guys kind of saving a pitch or saving an approach for later in the game when you know you're going to need it. But, you know, I think Snell knew he wasn't going to need that into the seventh, into the eighth. So it's like, let's just throw, you know, everything you've got at these guys early. And I think that that one is what enabled him to be a little bit more aggressive and more successful. But two, I think it's also why we saw him get the pull when we did.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to that, that if you know you're not going to be most likely getting through the sixth inning unless you've got incredible efficiency, then you just got to give it everything you got. And nine strikeouts, you know, over those 4 2/3 innings, you were never going to be efficient, because when you're striking out players, you're going to be using a lot more of your pitches. It's very rare that you're getting, you know, just three straight strikes and you're ending in a bat. It usually means that you're throwing quite a few pitches. So, you know, Blake Snell definitely had that working tonight, and the Dodgers just really couldn't touch him for a lot of the game until Chris Taylor got to him in that fifth inning there. The breaking ball was really working for him, and he was able to just really confound the Dodgers. Didn't seem like they were able to pick up his, you know, breaking stuff very much in that game. And, you know, I was thinking about this even yesterday with the Clayton Kershaw start and Tyler Glass now, that we got to remember that, you know, in a normal year, when it's not a pandemic going on, it's not a 60 game season, and it's a normal, you know, 162, there are interleague games. And I don't know if the Rays and Dodgers, at what point they would have been squaring off, but, you know, in a situation where you're not seeing these teams, I mean, you know, I'm sure some of these guys have faced Clayton Kershaw or faced Blake Snell, but it's been a long time since that has happened. And for this to be the first time this whole season that you're facing these guys, I imagine makes it a little bit tougher when you're at the dish and you haven't seen them enough during the regular season, or really seen them at all, especially this regular season.
Yeah, well said. Plenty of different things to confound guys at this time of year, and helping us, you know, pull apart or put together, I guess, these pieces of the puzzle. Danny Vietti, a writer for CBS Sports MLB right now. Danny, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Another great ball game today. It's the best time of the year, in my opinion, so I have no complaints on my side.
Yeah, it was definitely a fun game, both on and off the field. I don't know, maybe we'll get into it with you about the crazy guy throwing his glove onto the field. But there was actual baseball played, so let's start there. I was saying I was a little bit surprised at how good Snell was tonight, just because he is a guy who's a little more, he's a bit of a nibbler. He's a little more cautious with finding the strike zone at times, and this Dodgers team is so patient. Are you at all surprised that he was able to kind of, you know, walk or find the right line between, you know, expanding the zone and having to attack at times?
Not at all. He's a former Cy Young pitcher. He's done it before. Yes, he gets a wild hair up his nose sometimes, and he struggles to find his zone and struggles to attack. But we've seen this guy dominate the best lineups in the league. He's done it before. We haven't seen him do it at this stage, so that was incredibly impressive. And so this isn't to take away of how impressed I was with Blake Snell. It's just to say that this guy's legit. He has the stuff. He's proven that he can be not only an ace, but a Cy Young caliber pitcher. And I think really too many people were taking things away from game one and saying, well, the Dodgers are going to sweep now, this series is over. And I just didn't see that in game one. I personally saw in game one, I saw everything go right for Los Angeles. I saw Clayton Kershaw pitch fantastic. Their lineup was clicking all cylinders. And it wasn't as if the Rays played poorly. It was just everything went right for the Dodgers. They played a really good game. And so going into this game, too, I wasn't surprised at all to see the Rays bounce back, because maybe it's just I have more respect for that team and more respect for that franchise and how they play than maybe some of these other fans do, because I wasn't surprised at all to see the Rays bounce back and, you know, give the Dodgers a punch right back today, because it was an impressive performance by Blake Snell. But I'm not surprised at all by Tampa Bay, because people are surprised. This is a really good team. They're in this position for a reason. Some people, I guess, are still being surprised by this squad.
Yeah, Danny, it's so interesting with the, you know, the Rays, of course, and how they operate. We see it tonight where Blake Snell, you know, can't get out of the fifth, and they decide to go to Nick Anderson, a guy that's closed games for them. Then they go to Pete Fairbanks. Aaron Loop, the former Blue Jay, comes out, has a strong inning, and then Diego Castillo gets the final out to shut things down. And they've been doing that all season long, whether it's, you know, with openers or what have you. They're fine with going to the bullpen and running, you know, five, sometimes six or more guys out there. We saw the Dodgers use seven pitchers tonight, and I know some of the commentators have talked about about this during the postseason, that, you know, some teams have tried this where they go to the bullpen game and it hasn't worked out. And it makes sense because, you know, to expect seven pitchers to come out of the bullpen and not have any of them have a hiccup is, you know, a tough bet. And we saw it tonight with, you know, Dustin May getting lit up, Joe Kelly giving up a run as well. Like the Dodgers bullpen, they used six guys after Tony Gonsolin, you know, came out to start the ball game. To think that all six of those guys were going to come out and just be lights out, that's got to be a hard bet to make if you're Dave Roberts. That was the decision that they made, but that's got to be tough in that spot.
Yeah, I think that's a great point you make. And two, I don't think the Dodgers want to be, and I don't think they're using their assets as well if they go with that bullpen or that opener and a bullpen game. I think Tampa Bay, that suits them really well because they have three starters, Morton, Snell, and Glasnow. After that, it's really up to the bullpen. When you look at Los Angeles, they have five different starters that can pitch deep in the games. They have Kershaw, they have May, they have Urias, Gonsolin, and they even have Alex Wood back in that bullpen too, and of course Walker Buehler. I think what Los Angeles really needs to do is they need to utilize their strengths, and their strengths are having these starters go four, five, six innings because their strength really isn't in their bullpen. It's really not. You saw Blake Treinen get hit around the NLCS. You've seen Kenley Jansen velocity go down. And I know they're not using these two guys as much in these bullpen games. At least you didn't see that tonight. But I think you stretch some of these starters out. That's what they're used to. That's what they're comfortable doing. I think you throw out Tony Gonsolin for three, four, five innings. But unfortunately, when you throw him out there for an inning and a third and he gives up one run, it just kind of gets him out of his realm. It's so hard to get comfortable in a World Series game. And personally, I just think Dave Roberts, you know, overthinks things at times. He has so much talent, so much depth on that roster. Sometimes I think he thinks, well, maybe I should go here, maybe I should go there. I think personally, you don't want to fight fire with fire when you're playing the Rays, because that's what the Rays' strength is. I think if you're Los Angeles, you need to look at yourself in the mirror and say, what are our strengths? And I think their strength is their starting pitching and their ability to pitch deep in the ballgames.
No, that's really well said, and we're talking to Danny Vietti, MLB writer with CBS Sports here on Sportsnet tonight. Brent Gunning, Rob Wong alongside me. You mentioned Alex Wood there. I saw earlier in the series he was not poo-pooed as an option to potentially start a game if this series goes to a sixth game. He looked really good tonight. I guess the only problem with that, and I guess if he dealt with it well tonight, why would it be a problem if he gets a start? But you know, the Rays can load it up with lefties if they want. They're definitely capable of doing that. Would you look at Wood to potentially, and I know we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but you know, if they need a game six starter, would you think that makes sense or would you try to, you know, double back to Gonsolin or somebody else?
I personally, if I was managing that team, I would keep Wood out in the bullpen, and I want to go with my studs, the guys that have really carried me through this season. I would personally rather start Dustin May, rather start Tony Gonsolin than Alex Wood. They just have better stuff. Alex Wood has been in this league a little bit longer, has more experience. But if you're talking about stuff, those two guys they're just better overall at this point in their careers. I think Alex Wood is a perfect guy. If you want to do this opener thing, and I just mentioned how I don't think that's Los Angeles' strength, but if you really want to go that opener route, I think Alex Wood could be an option there, especially if the Rays load up with right-handed bats because they're facing Alex Wood and they're expecting Alex Wood to maybe pitch two, three innings. But if you take Alex Wood after two innings and then you put in a right-handed hitter, then it becomes kind of a matchup issue and you're going to see pinch hitters and substitutions, and it gets kind of ugly after that. But I personally, if it was me managing this team, I really like Dustin May. I know he got hit around a little bit tonight and he gave up that home run to Lau, but he's got great stuff. If he keeps that ball down the zone, he has that sinker, that triple-digit sinker working, and he gets his off-speed pitches going. I think if you stick with him and you have faith in him for four or five innings, you're going to get better results. But when you throw him out there for an inning every couple of days, that's just not what he's comfortable doing.
All right, Danny, let's get into some bigger picture questions here. And, of course, a lot of the narrative surrounding Clayton Kershaw continues to be that he can't get it done in the postseason and specifically the World Series. And, of course, we saw how incredible he was yesterday in game number one, and we'll see him pitch again at some point in this series. Is it possible, do you think, for him to change that narrative without the Dodgers winning a ring, or does that championship ring need to be on his finger in order for all the conversation to end?
Depends on who you're asking, right? If we're asking baseball Twitter, I'm sure they would say he needs a ring. And it really depends on how you look at, or what exactly the question is. Look, Clayton Kershaw is a first ballot Hall of Famer right now if he retires. It doesn't matter what he does in the postseason for the rest of his career. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer, one of the best pitchers we've ever seen pick up a baseball. But that being said, his resume, his postseason resume, it's impossible to ignore, and it's one of the most odd things we've seen in sports. We've never really seen a guy that dominant. And we're talking about across every sport here. It's not just baseball. We haven't seen a player, an athlete, this dominant in the regular season yet be that bad in the postseason. And I think part of it, he's been a victim of consequence at times, just kind of some bad luck at times, leaving pitches over the zone. But I really like seeing him dominate on the mound in game one, because I think sometimes we forget some of his good starts in the postseason because typically in the big moments he hasn't shown up. But he's had some good ones in the postseason. He came out of the bullpen in the NLCS a few years back, and he closed it in ninth to send the Dodgers to the World Series. And he's come out of the bullpen before, and he actually has done a decent job at times. Unfortunately, it's all these other times that take over, and people completely forget about his good outings. I was doing a little bit of research last night, and keep in mind there is some cherry-picking going on here. But Clayton Kershaw in the postseason, he has a lower ERA in his postseason career than Bob Feller. He's got a higher strikeout per nine than Randy Johnson, and he has a better strikeout to walk ratio than Greg Maddux in his postseason career. So yes, you can look at his ERA. Yes, you can see how many runs Clayton Kershaw has given up. But I personally think sometimes we look at the ERA too much, and we need to look at some of these other numbers too, because he hasn't been his regular season self, but I think he's actually been better than people give him credit for.
Yeah, I think that even the people who will like to yell and scream, choker, all of those things, I think they'll objectively say, yeah, of course there have been tremendous outings from Kershaw. I just think it's when you are the A1 pitcher of your generation, maybe the bar is just that little bit higher. Now, having said how great he was in game one, and I agree, he was transcendent, does it almost not matter now that we're almost certainly going to get another outing from him in this series? Like, it feels like he almost has to match that to kind of make those people change their tune in a potential Game 5 outing. Does what I'm saying make sense there?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And if you're asking me, what does Clayton Kershaw have to do to get this idea of him being a choke artist off his back, I think he needs one more really good outing, not six inning, three earned runs. He needs one really good outing, seven innings, one earned run, 10 strikeouts, the typical Clayton Kershaw that we see in the regular season. And Los Angeles needs to walk away with the ring. Because if Los Angeles fails again and comes up short, it's just going to continue that narrative. And even if he pitches fantastic in his next out and the Los Angeles Dodgers still lose the World Series, I still think that he needs that ring on his finger to basically solidify his career, solidify his resume. And so everyone can, all the haters out there can all stop talking about how Kershaw doesn't have a ring. They can stop comparing him to the Jim Kellys of the NFL and the Dan Marinos. He can be up there in the promised land with the greatest of the greats. He needs that ring, and I think that will finally stop all this hate coming from all these baseball haters and Clayton Kershaw haters.
Okay, big picture question number two, Danny, from me. And this isn't the first time this conversation has happened, but after game one, social media, of course, was losing their minds. And, you know, understandably so, Mookie Betts with an incredible game there. I don't agree with the notion, even though I saw it out on Twitter, but I'm going to ask you, is Mookie Betts the best player in baseball right now?
Not a chance.
That is correct.
Recency bias at its best, right? Of course, we're going to say that because we haven't seen Mike Trout play in a month. This is the world we live in. We see, it's funny, fans hold different players to different standards in the postseason. But the problem is we haven't seen Mike Trout in the postseason. We've seen him play three games, and he hasn't won a single game. And that's to no fault of his own. That's to me, that his franchise and his front office has completely failed him. Since 2015, every single Major League Baseball team has had a pitcher, represent them in the All-Star game. Every single team except for one. That's the Los Angeles Angels. They're the only team in the league to not have one All-Star represented one pitcher representative at the All-Star game since 2015. That is not Mike Trout's fault. That has nothing to do with him. And a lot of people say, well, Mike Trout could have chosen not to sign the contract. You're absolutely right. But at the same time, the front office hasn't held up their end of the bargain. You can't blame Mike Trout for their struggles. Going back to Mookie Betts, fantastic player. He's the athleticism this guy has, he does it in everything. He's a great bowler. He can see him catch a football. He's one of the best athletes in this game and one of the best players too. But stop it. It's impossible to compare Mike Trout and Mookie Betts. Mike Trout, if you look by the numbers, you look at his WAR, you look at his batting average, you look at his RBIs, you look at every analytical category you want to look at, Mike Trout has the advantage in some way. So Mike Trout's the best player in the game. It's sad that people even revert to that idea of Mookie being better just because Mike Trout isn't playing right now. It's recency bias at its finest. It's no comparison right now. Mike Trout is better.
Just saying, 1-for-12 in the postseason, 0.83 batting average, 2 strikeouts, caught stealing only. No, I agree with what you're saying, but
He's terrible.
Yeah, he stinks. I think we can all agree on this. Wouldn't we love to actually see the great Mike Trout be the great Mike Trout in the playoffs? That is something we can all get behind. And hey, expanded playoffs. Maybe that's the ticket to do it. Danny, thoroughly enjoyed the chat. I think you enjoyed it with the other half of this conversation more, but I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you tonight, bud.
Hey, I did too. Enjoy the rest of the series, guys. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
There he goes. Danny Vietti, MLB writer, CBS Sports. As soon as I heard it's not Mike Trout's fault, I'm like, I feel like he might have had something to do with it. And then I, sure enough, pulled up the postseason numbers, and I got to be honest, I couldn't remember what they were. So I was ready to eat some crow while I pulled it up. But my dear friends at Baseball Reference, yes, 1-for-12 in his postseason career. Now, I will give him credit. The one, 3-run shot. So I guess that's pretty good. I got to give him credit there. And he is the Barry Bonds of postseason because he in 15 plate appearances, just 3 walks. I thought they were intentional. Misreading things late at night. Here we are. Wong, there's a couple things. Anything from Danny there, or are you done settling old scores from our pregame show with the guest? Anything else jump out to you there?
I think, you know, Danny's right that, you know, the Clayton Kershaw conversation, it just depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to me about it, then I'm on the side of, yeah, I think, as Danny said, he's been a victim of circumstance at times, has, you know, been his fault at other times. Absolutely. But there have been moments that he has pitched well in the postseason, and it feels like people don't weigh that nearly as much as the times where he's had a big blow up, as we talked about, you know, in the pregame, that the goalposts seem to keep moving for Clayton Kershaw with some of these conversations that, oh, game number one against the Rays, it was the Rays, like, of course he's gonna do that. No, it's game one, like, it doesn't matter. But if he lost that game, or if he got knocked around by the Rays, it's, oh, Clayton Kershaw, playoff choker, couldn't even beat the Rays, and it's game one and he's already choking. So, like, you know, those are the kind of conversations that kind of annoy me when we talk about Kershaw and the narrative surrounding him. But, you know, all it comes down to is if he goes out next time out, game 5, game 6, whenever it is, absolutely shoves, pitches incredible, maybe it's a series clinching win, maybe he's on the mound for that, then the narrative completely flips. You know, David Price, nobody talks about him being a choker anymore because he was great in the World Series for the Red Sox a few years ago. He's got his ring. Probably should have had a ring or a chance at a ring if he did not decide to sit out the season. And we all understand why, of course, with COVID. But I actually forgot he was on the team until I saw that story come out earlier today, or was it yesterday, that he was talking about his decision to sit out and whether he regrets it or not. But yeah, that would have been kind of interesting, actually, to see David Price on this Dodgers team alongside Clayton Kershaw trying to chase down a ring.
Oh, you can picture it now. They're sitting next to each other in the dugout on nights neither of them are pitching, and it's just all, clearly he's talking to him about what exactly it means to get over the demons. Now, quickly, before we step aside here, I have got to give 30 seconds on the greatest character I've seen in baseball history at the game tonight. This guy who caught the ball in the stands, threw his glove on the field, had to throw him back to him. He has a really bad mustache. I'm allowed to say that. He also is wearing a mask underneath his chin because, hey, why not? At least you're trying. Just if you were watching the broadcast and saw that guy tonight, it was an incredible look. I know he caught your attention as well, Longer.
Oh, it was incredible. I was, you know, catching the Fox feed with Joe Buck and John Smoltz when that happened, and they showed the replay like a few batters later, and Joe Buck just, the glove gets tossed in the replay, and Joe Buck's just like, what? Like, he was so confused about what was going on, because this guy was like so excited that he caught the ball, and then I guess they watched back the replay again, and John Smoltz was like, yeah, he didn't mean to throw the glove, he was just so excited and his hands were flailing and he threw the glove onto the field, and Randy Rosarena, the Rays outfielder, threw it back to him. But hey, that's an all-time catch in postseason history. Like, that guy is gonna have that picture framed of him just like leaning all the way back over like three sets of seats catching that ball. So always weird to me when grown adults bring their baseball mitts to the field. I think that's saved for, you know, children and maybe teenagers. But hey, props to the guy. He caught the ball. You know, I think it's easier said than done that we could all just stand out there, sit in our seats and catch a baseball during the middle of a World Series game. But kudos to that guy.
He is in at least his 40s sitting with his wife, and I gotta know about the conversation as he's bringing his glove to the ballpark. It's like, you know, Jason's like out of the house. Our son is no longer here. You don't need to bring it to protect him. It's like, tonight's my night, honey. I can feel it. And hey, true to him, it was his night. The game was so good, we didn't even get to talk about Pete Fairbanks and his crazy eyes looking pretty wild out there. But something that's much more subdued than Pete Fairbanks' eyes, that is Mark Shapiro. We heard from him a little earlier today, and you will hear from him next. One segment left on Sportsnet tonight. Welcome back. Sportsnet tonight. World Series all knotted up at ones now. A little earlier today, we heard from a team not in the World Series, but striving to get there. It was from the Blue Jays, specifically Mark Shapiro. Here is a little snippet of that from earlier today.
For some fans and my own personal curiosity, your outlook, I mean, players have their contracts known. Charlie Montoyo has his contract known. Why do you prefer there not be clarity in terms of your own situation? And just so your fan base understands kind of this is the situation with this club's leadership as we, and you know, consider moving forward. We can expect the club to operate under this person's leadership for X amount of time.
Yeah, I just, you know, to me, I guess when the focus becomes in any way on front office executives, unless the team is really struggling, to me, when things are going well, there's not a lot of discussion about front office executives. At least there shouldn't be. We're not celebrities. We're not stars. We're here to do a job, and that job is ultimately for our fans, which is about the players in the field. And I think it's more of an extension of the desire to have that focus be on the players. And I think when things are going well, that naturally happens anyway.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Greg.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for the time. Just wondering if you could bring us up to speed on the minor league structure as it may pertain to 2021, and if there's any news you can confirm on the Vancouver Canadiens status.
Yeah, I can tell you definitively the report was not factual and inaccurate that came out yesterday with Vancouver. Unfortunately, we continue to try to get information. Major League Baseball has been overwhelmed with the amount of variables they've had to deal with this year. And the timing on a minor league plan for next year, although we've gotten some loose kind of insight, Greg, but we haven't gotten a firm answer of what that's going to look like. I think an understanding that it's going to be a reduced number of teams, that there's short season baseball is certainly not going to be the same. And then this plays into very well to the work we're doing down in Dunedin with our PDC, our player development complex, a greater reliance and dependence and focus on the complexes we have down there, because I think that most baseball executives feel like that's a better place for us to develop our players. But, you know, what our choices are, where they're between, has not been presented to us yet.
I just wanted to touch on payroll, given the uncertainty with the pandemic and whatnot, and where you might be playing next year. How much, can you chime in on what may be expected over the coming months here as we look ahead to preparing for the next campaign?
Yeah, our normal process is, you know, right now we're going through a series of meetings as a baseball operations staff, from scouts to our analysts to our coaching staff. We will continue to progress with those meetings into a presentation about a month from now to our ownership group, where we'll make a recommendation on a payroll for next year tied to a budgeting process. The reality of the pandemic, you know, clearly changes the dynamic of our revenues. However, there has been consistent support from our ownership, consistent encouragement that we continue to progress in our plan, that we continue to move forward. That was evident with Ryu, that was evident at the trade deadline, you know, in a very truncated season, very odd with zero revenue. We still added players and revenue at the trade deadline this year. And every indication has been very strongly that they expect us to continue to pursue where we need to add to our core, continue to pursue players this offseason. So that takes two parties, not just us, but the players we're pursuing. But I think the resources are going to be there. If we think the right deals are there and we make those recommendations, the resources are going to be there for us to add in a meaningful way, much like we, and we'll conduct this offseason much like last offseason.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Ben.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for the time.
Hey, Ben.
Of Greg's question there, if your presentation to ownership is in a month's time, free agency obviously will open up between now and then. What does that mean for you guys in the next month or so?
Be a little more specific, Ben. Is that, what does that mean as far as what we are doing, or what do you mean in the gap between that meeting and pursuing free agents? I'm trying to figure out exactly what you're asking.
I just mean if that meeting is in a month's time, then you know, in the meantime, you might not have that final word from ownership as far as payroll. So then if you're engaging with a free agent, for example, does that impact the way you have those conversations before that meeting where you would finalize that structure?
Well, there's a quiet period in there too. So I think you're actually probably only looking at about, you know, probably 7 to 10 days of actual bidding on free agents. And the history of free agents that have signed in the first 10 days is, I don't know if any ever have, you know, so, but I guess this is what I would tell you. We've already received a strong sense of support and encouragement to go out and pursue free agents. So I don't expect we'll be making bids in the first 10 days of free agency. That just doesn't, I mean, in my experience, that doesn't happen. You would be setting yourself up to bid against yourself, because not many free agents are ready to make decisions that quickly. I guess once in a generation that a player that says he wants to make a decision quickly, I feel like we could get an answer quickly, Ben. So but I think you're asking a question that really deals with an unlikely outcome and unlikely scenario. And again, I would say most importantly, we've been encouraged to go out and you know, pursue those.
They've been encouraged to go out and pursue those being free agents this offseason, they being the Blue Jays. What's not to like there? That was President Mark Shapiro. You just heard a snippet of that. There'll be plenty more Blue Jays talk and World Series talk on this station. World Series now tied up at ones. For Rob Wong, I'm Brent Gunning. Thank you so much for listening to Sportsnet tonight.